So please, let's welcome John Ciancioci. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Christine. I think you've got a new job ahead of you. Excellent announcer. And thank you all for turning up this evening. Some of you actually pay to come to these talks. I am often on your side listening to the speaker. And sometimes, not often, but occasionally, I feel that we should be paying the audience. I hope that will not be the case this evening. I'm very happy to be here to share with you. And as those of you who have heard me speak on previous occasions will know that I don't actually lecture. I like to contemplate and reflect on the topic with you. It doesn't mean that we're all going to talk at the same time. I'm going to talk most of the time, but in a way that encourages you to follow along and reflect on, not just that I am telling you something that you must accept as being fact or truth, and I'm the authority and you are the novice. We are equal. We're human beings. We're all of us on a quest for self-discovery, for meaning, for happiness, for fulfillment. And all of us have something to share. And so this evening, I'm in the role of the more active partner in this relationship in that I'm sharing something. You're more on the passive and receiving, but we are in it together. And hopefully this reflection will shed some light on the topic that I chose to speak about this evening, the way of the mystic, where concepts cannot reach. And I thought it was a really catchy title, and it's a very important that we get a catchy title in order for it to seem as if it's worthwhile coming to. Now, there are many parts to this topic that I would like to broach on this evening. And beginning with the last part of it, where concepts cannot reach, because that is the easiest part to speak about. You know, concepts, thought, that which we conceive in the mind, we bring into being in the mind, they're not so great. I mean, they're not as fantastic as we imagine, because what we imagine is all concepts. And it's not something that can reach every part of experience. I could have actually made the topic of this talk something much more mundane and yet equally valid. The taste of honey, where concepts cannot reach. You will never know the taste of honey by thinking about it, by describing it, by hearing about it, by philosophizing about it, by imagining what it is. It's impossible. It doesn't matter how many years you do that and how many books you write about it, because that's what people seem to do. They think about stuff and then they write books about it and it becomes, great volume of verbiage. Knowledge about something that type of knowledge cannot possibly know. It is much easier to just get a jar of honey and give everybody a teaspoon of honey. And you taste. It's the taste of honey. It's not something you know by thinking, by imagining, by conceiving, by comparing, by analyzing through intellect. Intellect cannot know that. In the same way, sound or even sensation. What does a hot shower feel like? You cannot know the feeling of that hot shower by thinking about it. You cannot know any of the other senses, the actual direct experience of a sensory contact sensation and experience through the ear, the nose, the tongue, and the body by thinking about it. It is something you know through a sensory perception. Then we, because we have an intellect and because we have a capacity, and unfortunately now most of us have actually an addiction, a neurosis that we can't stop thinking about, immediately we create. We compare, we analyze, we judge, and we create a whole host of mental concepts around every single experience. And we extrapolate it into the future, into the past, and we create this whole world, the world, conceptual world. And we live in that to a great extent. So concepts, valid as they are, necessary as they are limited. It's a field of experience that is limited, or an area of experience that cannot reach many, many other areas of experience, which must be known through direct perception or direct experience, if you wish. So on even a mundane level like that, so it makes it very obvious how limited our concepts are, how limited intellect is, how limited names and descriptions and images about things. They're limited, they're just shadows, just reflections. They're not the real thing. So what I'm trying to say here is that the fact that concepts cannot reach mystical experiences is to be expected, because the intellect is functioning at a very surface level, and it's at the level of reflection, or meaning image. It's not the real thing, it's just the image of something. It's just the extrapolation of something. It's not the immediate direct experience. So now, having said that about concepts, one can also say the pitfalls of concepts in that they are so alluring, so convincing, so able to compel us to believe them, that we will, we end up establishing all sorts of fixed views and beliefs, and we're quite prepared to defend those fixed views and beliefs about anything, really. But certainly, what I'm going to speak about this evening is, say, spiritual and religious matters. So we have these concepts and views and beliefs that we call religion, that then people will fight about and argue about, which one is true and which one has got the right description of the taste of honey. So let's go to war. My description of the taste of honey is the right one. Yours is not. And it's far removed from the taste of honey. And religions in general are about that. They're a philosophy and beliefs and descriptions, a set of views and dogma and doctrine and explanation. And they're far removed from the actual spiritual experience that maybe the founder of that system had, or what we would say is the mystical experience that that individual had. And so spirituality must be more interested in the mystical experience rather than just the conceptual belief system of a religion. That is the religion. So mysticism, it's very interesting now. What is this? What is a mystical experience and mysticism? And, can we say for sure? There are such a vast range of experiences that are often all grouped under mystical, in the sense that they're what? Unusual or mysterious. Mystical means concealed, So it's mysterious because it's not known, and it's not known in the normal way. So it's concealed to the normal range of experiences. So it's mysterious, mystical. And the mystic is the initiate who has, through direct experience, had that revelation of this thing that was concealed, and now it's revealed and it is known directly. That's the mystical experience. Now, there are many things, and again, I'm going to talk about known in what way. I've already said that not known through the intellect, not known through the reflection of, or the image that is created by the mind, thought, comparison. It has to be something more fundamental and direct than that. So this mystical experience is the revelation of something that was concealed, could not be known by ordinary means, is now experienced in a very direct way, personal way, and it is revealed. Now it is known through this direct experience. That is the mystical experience. That is the mystic. Sounds simple enough, but still, you know, there's a lot of things that are not known by direct experience. And there are many, many, or direct, normal experience through our senses or through, you know, the way we think. There is vast range of experience that for most ordinary people, you know, we don't have. And then when we hear about them, they are strange. Maybe they are mystical. So many of us have heard of out-of-body experiences. They're very common. I haven't had one, but I know people who have. Now, that's quite an unusual experience because normally we experience, you know, from within this body. And, you know, like we're in here and we see out there. Now, for me to be all of a sudden seeing myself from back there, looking at myself sitting here talking, would be quite an unusual experience. It's quite extraordinary. And yet people have that. It happens. It's not that uncommon. Near-death experiences are similar. And then there are also a vast range of unusual experiences, we can call them. You know, things that are out of the ordinary. Some people have prophetic visions of things that will happen, and then it happens. Some people have a premonition. Some people have the ability to actually see, you know, notice and even communicate with beings in other realms, or so they say. Now, that's quite extraordinary too. So there's a vast range of extraordinary experiences. Are they mystical experiences? Can we group them all as mystical because they are out of the ordinary? You know, it's just whatever we agree on. That's fine. We could do that. I would have to suggest that there may be some kind of out of the ordinary experiences that happen spontaneously to people. You know, whether or not they're truly mystical experiences may not be so important, but more important is what effect does it have on the person? I mean, what's the result of it? And some of these experiences do bring about quite a radical change in the person. And if the experience is of the nature that it breaks down some of the narrow confines of the very fixed views that have been constructed by the belief system and the worldview of based on this very small ego sense, if the experience is of the nature that it somehow begins to break through that limitation, and many of these experiences do that, because, you know, if you see yourself from outside, you kind of start wondering, you know, is that, what, am I just that little body there? Or if you have an experience of, you know, all of a sudden, I know people who have had such an experience. You know, I know this monk who was a very good meditator, and he'd been meditating for years. But he felt he'd made progress. And actually, he was accredited by this particular lineage as to be very advanced in his spiritual path, which he later said he didn't feel that was accurate. However, one day he was riding on the back of a bus, just sitting on the back of this bus, traveling from southern Thailand towards Bangkok to go on some business or other. And spontaneously, he had this quite out of the ordinary experience where all of a sudden his sense of self as a limited, separate being just dissolved away. And he felt his heart just opening up and his perception opening up. And in his mind, there was this, the unity of everything in that bus. And then it just expanded. And the unity of life, just the sense of oneness with everything. And that lasted for quite some time for him. And it wasn't something he was kind of, you know, was prepared for or had tried to instigate. It just happened. One can say that it was the result or of the many years of training, maybe. I don't know. But the result of that experience was quite, for him, remarkable in that it really did change him. He really felt a new, you know, just a new openness. His heart was, he really could relate to this ideal that the oneness of all life, not just as a concept, but from this experience. So it's kind of a mystical experience, one would have to say, because it broke down the narrow barrier created by the concept belief system, by the sense of self being limited and separate, and broke down that division of me and others, and opened the heart. So that's quite an experience. So that there are some of these mystical experiences that happen spontaneously of a great variety of characteristics, they're very different, that may actually bring about a similar result, the sense that the ability to break down, the ability to open the heart, the ability to expand the mind from the limited, very small, to a grander view of life. So one would have to say that, you know, if it is anything like a mystical experience, I would expect to see that sort of result from it. I would not expect to see that the mind becomes even more rigid, even more dogmatic, even more fixed in a narrow view. So if those experiences that tend to do that, I'm very reluctant to call them mystical experiences, because in the range of out of the ordinary experiences, there are countless experiences. So someone has an experience where they have a near-death experience, and then they they have the experience of light, perception of light, and in the light they see, you know, Jesus, Mary, I don't know, who else? Somebody from a particular, you know, kind of one view of spirituality or existence. In other words, that's still very, that experience is still narrow and limiting. And although it's out of the ordinary, this person comes back from this near-death experience and says, I am absolutely certain that Jesus is the way to salvation and no one else. I wouldn't call that really a mystical experience. I would call that, you know, a really out of the ordinary experience, but not a freeing one. It is one that's, if anything, just makes the mind more rigid. However, you know, each one of these cases is, you know, it's the individual has that experience. You can't generalize and say all those experiences are equal or all of them are mystical or none of them are mystical. They're just out of the ordinary so far. Some of these experiences are even can be brought on by, you know, physical trauma. There is a very good book by My Stroke of Insight. If you haven't read it, it's a really remarkable story. Dr. Jill Bolt Taylor. She studied the anatomy of the brain and had this quite major stroke, which according, you know, to the afterwards, we learned that it more or less shut down the left hemisphere of her brain. But she had this, you know, when it was happening, it was like, you know, all of a sudden she, you know, because of the stroke and the pressure on that shut down circulation or whatever, the functioning of the left side of the brain, she lost all, you know, language. Just like that, just complete silence. That would be a blessing. Not the stroke. I don't think I want the stroke, but it would be really something. You know, sometimes we want to shut that off, don't we? Just shut up. You know, you could just shut that off. All the language, the concepts, the dialogue, the sense of me as separate from others, me as being better or worse, or important, not important, and all of that, the creations of that part of the mind. And that just went silent. And in this silence, there was still experience. And the experience one was from, as she describes it, from the right side of the brain. Now, I don't know anything about the anatomy of the brain. I'm just repeating this. From the right side of the brain, which is more sensitive to just the present moment, just present moment, raw, unembellished, sensory experience. And so she, you know, there was this vibrant, sensory present of the moment, but also a heightened awareness of the kind of the barriers were not so clear anymore between her, what she took to be herself, the body normally, and the outside, the world, that it was actually just this experience of being sensitive to each other, the ability to have this interaction. And so she had this experience of being more like just part of this, the universe and everything in the universe, and in quite an extraordinary way. And that was just the beginning of the story. It goes on. Her story is quite remarkable. Please read it. But again, something like that, you know, physical trauma to the brain caused this radical shift in the way that she experienced. We call that a mystical experience. I would have to say, probably, yes. It certainly seems to have had that effect on her, that she saw that, you know, broke that, the barriers, opened that the heart and the mind that could see that she was not just an isolated me, separate from all and everything else, but just part of a whole. So it had quite a strong impact on her. And when she recovered, she lectures and teaches based on that experience. Quite remarkable. Similar experiences, sometimes not as dramatic, sometimes not so pleasant either. People may have be able to induce through drugs, hallucinogenic drugs, and various things cause, you know, kind of a radical change in perception into out of the ordinary, dramatically different perception. And it's difficult to really call those mystical experiences, but one cannot rule it out completely, because some of those people, having had something that really does open their heart and their mind, do, you know, as a result of that, then start being quite different in the way they live their lives and view themselves in relation to others and the world and what they aspire to, and their values have changed. So, you know, I'm not going to pass judgment on all of those. I don't recommend those things. There are other, you know, really bizarre kind of experiences that people have. They're all really good stories. My teacher, Venerable Ajahn Chah, earlier on in his training, when he was a young monk, and he'd been practicing for quite some time and was quite accomplished in his meditation, but he said that he came to a blockage. He couldn't get past this particular stage in his meditation. So he went to see if he could find a more advanced or mature meditator teacher who maybe could advise him. And he'd heard of this supposedly quite accomplished meditator who lived on top of this mountain, but it's not a big mountain. It's just a hill. So he went to see this monk, and you know, this is quite an ascetic monk. He's practices, and Ajahn Chah went to him and stayed the night with him, and you know, asked, you know, I'm having this trouble with my meditation. It'll only go so far, and it comes like I hit this brick wall. Like, you know, it won't go beyond that. And the monk says, well, that's just a limit of perception. And Ajahn Chah didn't quite understand that, nor do I. But then the monk said, oh, that's nothing. You know, in meditation, anything can happen. The mind can do anything. You can imagine something. There, the mind can do it. So that's nothing. You know, I'll tell you something. The other day I was doing walking meditation, and the forest monks, we do walking meditation on a path about 15 yards in length, and you just walk back and forth at a slow pace, concentrating on the movement of the feet. And quite often in Northeast Thailand, they use a mantra, Buddho, Buddha, and they one foot, Buddho, Buddho. And it's, you know, it's a very good way to settle, calm, start to concentrate the mind. It's a standard meditation practice. So he's doing this meditation, he said. I was walking up and down, and then I come to the end of the path, and all of a sudden I feel my body sinking into the earth, and I'm sinking, and my ankles are in the earth. Then it's down to my knees. Then I'm down to my waist. Then I go down to my shoulders. I try to hold my head up, but I keep going down, and I end up going deep, deep down into the earth. And then it stops. And then as I'm standing there right in the deep into the earth, I start rising up, and my head comes out, and I feel relief. And then my body comes out, and then I'm standing, and I thought it would be all right. And then I keep rising, and I keep going up and up and up, and I'm going up, 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 and now I'm up above the treetops, and I'm kidding. And then, boom, my body explodes. My body explodes, and all the parts of the body go flying all over the place. The intestines get strewn over the branches of the trees. My limbs go scattered all over the ground. My head goes flying over, and I'm all in peace. And Ajahn Chah is listening to this, and he said, you sure you're not dreaming? And he says, no, I wasn't dreaming. It's just unusual perception, distorted perception, something that can happen. The mind can create something like this. Did he really sink into the earth, or was it just the perception. Something changed, shifted. So it's really bizarre. What can you make of that? It's just making the point that as far as the creation of the mind, the range of experiences, you know, it's vast. It's limitless. You can imagine it, the mind can do it. So, mystical experiences are out of the ordinary. They cannot be experienced in the normal sense that we normally experience life. They have a wide range, you know, they can be anything. Maybe, oh, I forgot to tell you, I prepared this really good start for this talk. It's a bit late. But, you know, in the Sufi tradition, they've got lots of teachers. Mulla Nasruddin is one such teacher. And one day Mulla Nasruddin was in the audience, and one of the great teachers was in speaking, and he was giving this talk on a spiritual matter, and Nasruddin says, "Excuse me, sir, you're talking a lot. Have you got references from scripture and texts to back up what you have to say, what you're saying?" And the man says, "What? No." "Well, how do we know what you're saying is just not a bunch of words empty of any meaning and any substance? It's just you blabbing up there." Fine. He stopped talking. The next time he came to this village to give a talk, he came prepared. And he sat down to give his talk. Sure enough, there's Nasruddin. And when I see Ben sitting back there, and that's why he's there. Nasruddin, you know, after the man has been talking for some time, "Excuse me, sir, seeing that you're talking so much with such authority, have you got text and scriptural notes to back up what you are saying?" "Aha, my man, I do. I have vast tracts of text and references." "Ah, what a fool," Nasruddin says. "He doesn't have any confidence in what he's saying. He doesn't even know what he's talking about. He's just saying, repeating some words from books." So, my friends, I came prepared for both. But I'm not a scholar and I don't have a lot of text. But I did get this definition of what mystical experience is. William James, who's a psychologist and philosopher, he identifies, I don't necessarily agree, but, you know, just to make sure that I have some textual reference here. He says that the mystical experiences, one, is ineffable. Mystical states are more like states of feeling than intellect, subtle, shaded with fine nuances that are difficult to convey in their import and grandeur to another. All he's saying is that they're not, you know, it's not an intellectual thing that you can convey through intellectual thought. It's, you know, it's rarefied. Noetic in quality, that's a great word. Mystical experiences are states of knowledge, insight, awareness, revelation, and illumination beyond the grasp of intellect. There is awareness of unity with the absolute, of immortality of the soul, of great truths. That I don't agree with, but the first part I thought was really good. And the next one, he says, transiency. Mystical experiences are fleeting in linear time, though they seem to be eternal. And he says that most of them are very brief, maybe only a few seconds. That I don't agree with either, but most of them are like that when they occur spontaneously to people. Passivity. The individual feels swept up and held by a superior power. This may be accompanied by a sensation of separation from bodily consciousness, similar to an out-of-body experience, he says here. So what he's really saying is that you lose control. You're no longer the doer, the will. that's doing it. It happens to you. And these are actually, you know, the idea that it's ineffable, it's something that you can't just pin down with an image, or you can describe it, but it's not it. Just like you describe the taste, it's not the taste. Noetic, it's a quality that can be known, not through thinking about it. Whatever you think, it is not that. Okay? Transiency, of course it's transient, but it doesn't mean it doesn't last for more than a second. It can last actually for hours, many hours. Passivity, yes, in the true mystical, deep mystical experience, there is the, you know, it's like you, the doer, the controller, you, that part of your left brain, if you wish, that's always stops, dies temporarily. And that's why that experience is so vividly different. Now, what I'd like to talk about just briefly next is, you know, what I think is really not, you know, I said that mystical experience can be, use that term for a big variety of things, but if we want to, you know, really, it's just like saying, using the word enlightened. You know, this is the enlightened age, we're all enlightened. Well, I guess it all depends what you mean by enlightened. If you mean the complete enlightenment like of a Buddha, well, maybe we're not quite like that. Well, you know, are we more enlightened in some areas? Yeah, maybe so. It's like insight. You have an insight. I had an insight into why I get angry. I get angry because my pride is hurt. You know, it's an insight. Is it radical? No, it's just a little insight, a little understanding. And the same way with the mystical experience, you know, there are variations, the really deep ones, things that are really, the experience is so profound that it is quite extraordinary in a way that brings an extraordinary radical change. In the Christian tradition, the commentator Paulane, I think it is pronounced, he writes about St. John of the Cross and St. Teresa of Avila. And he describes the state as follows. Then the spirit is transported high above the faculties into a void of immense solitude, whereof no mortal can adequately speak. It is the mysterious darkness wherein is concealed the limitless good. To such an extent are we admitted and absorbed into something that is one, simple, divine, and illimitable, that we seem no longer distinguishable from it. In this unity, the feeling of multiplicity disappears. When afterwards these persons come to themselves again, they find themselves possessed of a distinct knowledge of things, more luminous and more perfect than of others. This state is called the ineffable obscurity. This obscurity is a light to which no created intelligence can arrive by its own nature. Created intelligence, I would like to just say, like, it is an experience that intellect cannot arrive at. It's not that the individual, the person, and you know, that you can't experience that. It's just that you can't get there through your intellect. Concepts cannot reach it. In the Heart Sutra, what is apparently the same state is expressed as follows. And no feeling, thought, impression, understanding, and no eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind, no form, sound, smell, taste, touch, or thought there exists. And that's something beyond. So in the deepest sense, if we really think about, you know, the mystical experience that is, you know, something that goes completely beyond what? Beyond concepts? Of course, it has to go beyond concepts. But beyond the world and that which is known of the world. Beyond all normal experience. And normal experience, the taste of honey is still a normal experience. You cannot know it by concepts, but you can know it through one of your senses. Correct? Yes. Oh, can you wait a minute, 2 minutes? I'm on a roll now. I got to finish in a few minutes. I'll just let me continue. It's so, there is the idea that, especially in Buddhism, that it is possible for us to experience something beyond not only the normal range of experience, but beyond the dualistic, the conceptual, and the sensory. And that is, one would say, a really deep mystical experience. And this is what deep meditation is striving for. So that in meditation, it is an introspection. It is going in. It is a process of shutting down. It is a process of shutting down the receiving sensory information. So you're going in towards stillness, towards silence. You're endeavoring to quieten the active conceptual intellect part of the mind that is continually, the continually carrying on, which is thinking about. So through this process, and the meditation technique is not so important. It does not matter what meditation technique you do, as long as it is going in that direction of moving towards stillness, stilling the activities of the mind, the body, stilling all the waves, as it were, in consciousness, moving towards ever greater silence, ever greater stillness, ever greater peacefulness, calmness, serenity, deeper and deeper. So that the mind begins to, in that stillness and silence, something quite dramatic happens, quite extraordinary happens. And it doesn't matter what meditation technique you use. And this is spoken about by all meditators in all tradition. Whatever the object of attention, as the natural thing that happens as the mind becomes increasingly quiet and still, there is the manifestation of the basic nature of consciousness, which is luminous, radiant. The only reason that the radiance and the luminosity of the mind is not perceived, experienced, is because of the waves that continually disrupt, continually cause turmoil. But once the mind starts approaching this deep state of stillness and singularity of attention on whatever object, that natural luminosity of the mind starts to manifest. And this is not uncommon. Many meditators, when they come out, they talk about seeing light, seeing a light, or lights. The important thing is that they're not seeing in the normal sense. It's just, again, this perception is not through the eye. It is the reflection of the pure mind. But you have to describe it, and so you come and say, it's seeing. You saw light. The experienced meditator, and this is why it's, the mystic, the way of the mystic is, we're interested in trying to experience something mystical, something truly mystical, something that is a revelation that frees us, frees the mind from its constrictions, the narrowness, the separation, and therefore the vulnerability and the inadequacy that we all feel. So if the mystic is one who's, or the aspiring mystic, and I think we all are. Some of us more dedicated than others, but we're aspiring. That's why you came here this evening. You know, it is really important to keep developing one's practice of meditation, because it is through this process of calming, stilling, making the mind more peaceful, removing the waves that cause turmoil in the mind, that we begin to actually have this direct experience of the natural luminosity of the mind. And that is the doorway to a radical, really radical mystical experience. This is Ajahn Brahm. I've come really prepared tonight. You know? Let's see what I do. There's this very good quote from the Buddha. "The mind, O monks, is luminous, but it is defiled by," and I've set myself up, "adventitious." Is that how you pronounce it? Adventitious defilements. Visiting. They take advantage, they creep in, they come in. Advantageous? No, it's spelled differently. But let's say visiting defilements. "The uninstructed worldling does not understand this. This mind, O monks, is luminous and is freed from these visiting defilements. The instructed noble disciple understands this. And for that one, that person, therefore for him, there is mental development. There is the possibility of this experience that can happen." So freeing the mind from those defilements, as the Buddha calls it, or we can say these waves that keep it in turmoil. That's all we're doing. We're stilling, we're calming, we're bringing the mind to greater sharpness, awareness, stillness, silence, calmness, that begins to become very enjoyable. It's really wonderful to be in that peaceful state of silence, freed from all the complexity of thinking about and worrying about and your 30, 40 years of baggage and emotions that are unresolved. And so there's this sense of relief as you let all of that go, the sense of liberation and freedom. It's a sense. It's joy, the joyful mind. It's light. And this radiance begins to manifest, this luminosity. And through practice and diligent practice, one can use this luminosity to go into something. And this is what Ajahn Brahm says. "Here you have an experience that you might describe afterwards in two different ways, depending upon your perspective. Either you find yourself sinking or diving into this luminous perception, nimitta, he calls it. It's luminous mind perception. Or the nimitta, this luminosity, with its brilliant light and ecstatic feeling completely envelops you. You don't do this. It just happens as the natural result of letting go of all that doing. Less doing, more letting go, more being. Starve the doing, feed the being." "You enter into this absorption through liberating the mind." And "the mind is now free. This is free from the body and the five senses. It's not that I'm saying that the mind is floating somewhere in and out of the body experience. You are not located in space anymore, because all experiences of space are dependent on the five senses. Here the mind is free from all of that. You're not at all sensitive to what's happening with the body. You are unable to hear anything, unable to say anything. You're blissed out, yet fully mindful, still, stable as a rock. These are the signs of the mind being freed. This experience becomes one of the most powerful, if not the most powerful experience of your life. When you spend hours," that's why I questioned when that gentleman said that it's, you know, maybe a few seconds, he you're talking about hours in this thing. When you spend, so the mind is completely withdrawn, and then it reaches a point of stillness and a point of joy and rapture that it has enough, if you wish, courage or momentum to just go into this, and into this pure state. It is timeless, there is no time. It is limitless, there is no sense of identity. There is no world, the world has ceased. There is no concept, you are unable to think. There is no will, there is no doer. There is no comprehension in such a state. Comprehension is always dependent on conception, on measuring, on comparing. So it is a state where you really, you know, you just disappear. The doer disappears, the world disappears. When you've spent hours in a jhana or an absorption, you can call yourself a mystic, if you like. You've had an experience that in all religious traditions is called a mystical experience, something far from the ordinary. The Buddha called it something that surpasses ordinary human experience. He also called it the mind gone to greatness. Having had such an experience, the world will have less attraction for you. Relationships, the arts, music, movies, sex, fame, wealth, and so on, all seem so unimportant and unattractive compared to the experience of that beyond. So, my friends, it's obviously, you know, something extraordinary. And we could say kind of a pinnacle of mystical experience, but not the pinnacle of spiritual life. Because that mystic is still not enlightened. Because there is unenlightened mystics. Having had such a profound experience is profoundly life-changing. But it does not necessarily indicate enlightenment. But it certainly indicates somebody who's experienced something beyond. And I would like to suggest that though we may not be that committed and diligent about it, but maybe we could all keep it as a thought, those dreaded things, thoughts, maybe an aspiration that this could be a lifelong goal for us. And it may continue to inspire and motivate us to put a little more time and effort into our practice of meditation. Thank you very much for giving me all this time. I will take questions.
Does anybody have any questions for John? Okay, hold on, I'm over here. Here you go. Just
speak into me. So based on what you said, do you think the Christian mystical experience is different than the Eastern mystical experience?
Not when it's really truly deep mystical experience, because it does transcend. You know, the experience has got nothing to do with concept and image of, you know, something that is created by the mind. It is not a created thing by the mind. Where the difference would come is when they, let's say two authentic mystics who've had this really profound experience, and as that first quote that I read from the Christian tradition, that sounded to me exactly the same as, you know, what Ajahn Brahm there is saying. The way they may speak about it or try to bring it into the conceptual realm, you know, will depend on their conditioning, just like the language they use, the imagery they use, the associations they will draw. But I do believe that the deeper the experience, the less limited they will be by in the way they describe it. They won't be, well, I don't expect them to be very rigid. However, at, say, less, you know, experiences that are still out of the ordinary and we could classify as mystical, that are still very much tied in with the conceptual worldly or religious imagery and belief. They can be very different. But I really do believe that true mystics who do transcend the conceptual and do experience something beyond the world. You know, we have the world. When I say beyond the world, you don't kind of go to the moon. I mean, it's like beyond just that which is known through the senses or through the intellect. And yet it is known, and it is more real. They would share a common way of pointing.
Any other questions?
I'm trying to word this properly. When you say beyond world, so that's ineffable or indescribable, but it would seem that there would, if it's not going to be a rigid experience, if it's going to be this all-opening experience without worldly judgment, then love or your heart or an emotion of that sort would have to be attached to it, yet there's supposed to not be attachment. So how do you explain that?
Well, one of the characteristics of it is that to have that experience is always associated with great rapture and joy. That is not an emotion. It's because the mind, for the mind to withdraw and to, you know, really be that content, it has to be really happy because otherwise it won't do it. It just won't go there. So there has to be this, you know, tremendous sense of contentment in the mind. So, with the mind, there are no waves, and the mind is not. And what makes it so contented is that it's such a beautiful state. And so the experience, you know, and all mystics, you know, speak of this great rapture and the bliss, and are associated with that, leaving the world behind. And the world is the world of the senses, and outside of the senses, the residual concepts about the sensory experience, the thoughts. So you leave that behind, and so there's this bliss. Now, not an emotion, and emotions are usually of a different quality. This is a very pure bliss or joy. Coming from that experience, of course, you know, happy people usually are happy people just, you know, they just bring a lot of positive emotions. They just overflow with positive emotions. It's, you know, it's only miserable people who go around with creating trouble. I mean, really happy people, I mean, they don't. That's the natural outflow because they're really happy. So I expect that they would be really an outpouring of positive emotions.
Any other questions over here? Hold on, let me go over here. Who had their hand up? Okay, here you go, sir.
I was wondering if it's possible to have a mystical experience for someone that's not on a spiritual path.
Yes. As I said, some of these things just happen spontaneously. You know, again, I don't know about the really, like I was talking about, this really quite extraordinarily deep experience. But as I indicated earlier in the talk, there are a wide range. And as I said, some of, you know, quite out of the ordinary experiences that can be brought on by something as unexpected as a stroke. You know, something, you know, changes the brain, causes a very different perception. You know, it may not be the highest mystical experience, but it is sufficiently changed that person's view of life. So yes, I think so. It can happen spontaneously, and it can be. But you know, we can't just wait around for us to have to. You know, just that's why most spiritual paths have, you know, certain practices that we undertake in order to try and facilitate it.
We've got a question here in the back.
In the Hindu tradition, I've seen it very frequently where the mystics seem to be the spiritual leaders. And in the same breath, the vast majority of the mystics are also considered to be saints. Can you give an idea or an explanation as to why this connection might be true?
Well, I would say that, you know, we've just said that it can happen to anyone, you know, some kind of a variety of mystical, so-called mystical experiences. But it is equally true that people who devote themselves, you know, they devote their lives to training and living a life that is conducive or facilitates the arising of these pure states of consciousness, some of them become adept. In other words, they can enter these states, not just waiting for it to happen, but they actually, you know, they are able to shift into this pure abode, if you wish, or pure experience. And so they usually are spiritual people who've lived their lives, you know, to develop that sort of skill. It's like, you know, you want to be a mountaineer, or you've got to really devote a lot of time. So they're living a particular type of life that, you know, usually we call a renunciate or spiritual person. And then, because if they do become adept at doing that, or if they do have these experiences, to whatever degree, yes, then they would be like the spiritual leaders in that tradition that they are associated with. So that makes sense. In terms of whether they, you know, I'm not sure if the suggestion is that maybe they are still trapped within a particular rigid belief system of that particular religion. I would find that may be the case, because maybe their experience, their mystical experience, isn't as, you know, it's all a matter of degrees. So maybe they're just freed a little bit from the shackles and the barriers of the restriction. They're not completely enlightened. But most, you know, mystics, people who are truly, one is that they're living a spiritual life. Two, they're practicing in a way that is facilitates and conducive to refined states of experience and consciousness, purity of mind. And they have those experiences. You know, they inevitably, I think you won't find them to be rigid, narrow, you know, people. As I said, one is I would expect them to be quite happy. Two, I would expect them to naturally have positive emotions towards others and see life in a very, you know, open way, in the unity of all life. I would find it very, you know, I would find it very unusual if that was not the case.
Anyone have any other questions they'd like to ask John? No?
I just wanted to ask you.
Wait, hold on. 1 second.
She's tough.
You're talking about mystical experiences, but you do not talk about them as the same as enlightenment. Could you describe to us how you see them as different in your view?
Well, I started off by saying that mystical experiences is a wide range. You know, we can start off just saying they're out of the ordinary. They're not known in the ordinary way. So there's a whole bunch of them. But even something that I've described here, you know, what Ajahn Brahm described, is a, you know, this very pure state of mind, where the mind completely withdraws from the intellectual part of the mind, ceases, you know, comprehension, will, doing, understanding, you know, it just ceases. It just dies. And the world disappears. Boom. Actually, sometimes I do talk, it's like an explosion. The world, I mean, there's just no world. And there is no time. And there is no space. And there is no you or another. There is a singularity of tremendous clarity and bliss, is how it's described, okay? So that's tremendous. And the Buddha did describe that as, and he actually said that it's the purity and the happiness and the freedom of that experience, those qualities, is very close to the enlightened state. But the reason why it is not enlightenment, for a start, this is within the Buddhist context, is because one is you come out of it. Certainly there's the residual effect, and the residual effect is quite powerful, and it may last for quite some time. But it doesn't last, all the time. Also, it can deteriorate. You can lose that ability. If you start practicing, you lose it, and you just can't experience that. So it is a conditioned state. It is still a conditioned state. It's dependent on certain factors. And it does not eradicate, I said it does open the heart and open the mind, and you start, you have an understanding that the world is, and there is something beyond this dualistic and conceptual, and you know the limit of thought, and you know the limit that you are not the doer. You're not will. You're not the guy doing all that, because that can cease and there's still awareness. But knowledge of that sort is profound and quite extraordinary, but it is still not sufficient to eradicate this firm belief in self. You still have conceit. You still have desire and aversion. You still attach. You still have attachment. Even though this experience was so extraordinary and it's had its impact, but it hasn't, it hasn't really been the earthquake that's, just completely torn away those beliefs or those views. And so the enlightened experience is one that actually permanently eradicates something like the view of a self as a separate self. And so that's the distinction I would make. But this is, within the Buddhist framework.
Oh, we'll take one more question from the audience, and then if there's any on webcast. Okay, here you go.
I read once something I found really interesting. It said, the psychotic drowns in the same thing that the mystic swims in. And if you'd care to comment on that, that's fine. But my question is a mystical experience ever frightening?
For a start, to address your first comment, it's my teacher used to say exactly the same thing. Ordinary people cannot tell the difference between an enlightened person and a crazy person. They are both different. They're different from the ordinary. And the same with this, like a mystical experience. I said there's a great variety, but there are some. It's difficult to talk about mental disorders because there are such a variety of them, and some of them do result in people having such, kind of really either bizarre or strange, out of the ordinary perception experience of themselves and life, and also a tremendous conviction of its reality, and maybe they live in a way which is quite extraordinary. Some of them develop great followings. It's quite frightening because they are, they believe their experience so much. So it is difficult. What was the second part of the question?
Are mystical experiences frightening?
If we allow that mystical experience is anything really just, really out of the ordinary, that is not experienced in an ordinary sense, I would say that there are many experiences that are quite frightening, but I would be loath to call them mystical experiences. I can't generalize, but I know people have, experiences that do frighten them. But usually they are, because it's just distorted perception, things coming up from their own mind. So it's just stuff that they're not able to I would say that it's not a real mystical experience, but it's certainly a distorted perception of sorts, like floating in the air and blowing up and your intestines going all over. Is that a mystical experience? Well, you know, it's pretty bizarre. It could be quite frightening too. And certainly, you know, it's just out of the ordinary. So the word is, you know, it does depend on how much we want to encompass by that word. I started off by just saying it's, you know, out of the ordinary, but then I wanted to see if we could limit it to something spiritual and then, you know, really kind of a high degree of spirituality or spiritual experience. I am not an expert on mystical experiences because there's just so many. You know, people have so many experiences. I would always say, well, you know, it's real to you. You had that experience. What are you going to do with it? And so, what are you going to do with it? Ed, you were going to ask a question. Are you going to ask a question?
I'll make a comment.
The thing that concepts overlook is the fact that everything is unique. Mm-hmm. And the fact that it's unique means you can't fit it in a concept. And that's true about what we call mystical experience. They're all unique.
That is a valid point. Just like we say, you know, okay, you can't know the taste of honey by thought, but you can't, you know, the taste of honey one time is not the taste of honey another time. So there is a uniqueness. But then we, you know, when we, in order to communicate and point, we, you know, we're going to balance trick. Well, thanks.